Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations, where we talk about mental health, adversity, spirituality, and societal issues. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. And in this week's episode, I welcome a remarkable guest whose work has been dedicated to shattering stereotypes and advocating for a more inclusive world. Join me as I sit down with the inspiring Ruth Rathbott, a passionate advocate for disability inclusivity. Ruth, a disability rights activist and visionary leader, opens up about her personal journey with disability and how it has fueled her unwavering commitment to challenging societal norms. Ruth delves into her experiences with grace and resilience, discussing the obstacles she has faced and the misconceptions she has shattered along the way. Tune in to hear Ruth's profound insights on disability inclusivity, the importance of authentic representation, and the urgent need for change in the DEI landscape. Discover how she is leveraging her unique perspective to drive conversations that challenge the status quo and demand a more inclusive and equitable future. Through candid and thought-provoking discussions, I, with Ruth, explore the critical intersection of disability advocacy and DEI initiatives. We dissect why the current DEI framework may fall short and provide powerful insights into how it can be reimagined to serve marginalized communities better. Personally, I'm not a big fan of the metrics used in organizations to achieve diversity and inclusivity. I did bring that to attention during the episode. However, there's more to explore in this space. Take advantage of this thought-provoking conversation between me and Ruth and prepare to be inspired by Ruth's drive and resilience. Ruth Rathbott is an expert on inclusion and diversity. She is a TEDx and inspirational speaker, best-selling author, and an award-winning former nonprofit leader. She was born with a limb difference and speaks with leaders on issues of equity and belonging, the gifts of being unique, and the freedom to accept differences. Ruth was profiled as a CEO in the New York Times corner office and received Goucher College's Excellence in Public Service Award, among other awards, for her outstanding leadership in the nonprofit sector. She has spent her entire career focused on providing opportunities for those who have been underrepresented. She serves as a board member of the Lucky Finn Project. You can find Ruth on her website at ruthrathbott.com, and you can find her TEDx titled When I Stopped Hiding, I Found Freedom. She's also released her book, Single-Handedly Learning to Unhide and Embrace Connection. And if at the end of the episode, you could leave a 5-star review, I would truly appreciate it. Brief word for our sponsors. So I would like to talk about deodorants because I'm tired of constantly replenishing my deodorant and then having to worry about disposing those plastic containers. There's a solution for that. Wild. Wild provides an eco-friendly, all-natural deodorant with a sustainable design. They provide a for-life aluminum case. For me, they sent me a personalized case with my name on it. And did I mention you can customize your orders and have these refills delivered straight to your door? This is an all-natural solution where there's no aluminum in the product, just in the case. Go to wearewild.com and use code EASY at checkout for 25% off your first order. All right, Ruth, welcome to the Easy Conversations podcast. Thank you for joining me today and thank you for your persistence. I appreciate it very much and I'm really excited for the conversation we're going to have. But before we get started, I want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself and let the listeners know a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
Yes, I am Ruth Rathblad, and I work with leaders to expand the conversation on diversity to be much more inclusive so that their employees can unhide thrive, and belong. And I do that through expanding the conversation on diversity to talk about and discuss disability. So that's my passion project and to start this movement around unhiding.
Mm-hmm. And you're also a TEDx speaker. So just want to highlight that.
I'm a TEDx speaker and a best-selling author. So we have both of those things going on and a former nonprofit executive. So yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I guess just getting right into it, why are you so passionate about helping leaders have that awareness and be more mindful of inclusivity specifically and specifically around disabilities?
I think there's two reasons. One is there was a kind of pivotal moment in my career as a nonprofit leader where at one point I was questioned about the leadership and diversity of leadership in an organization I was part of. Mm-hmm. And it made me reflect and think about things. And then I asked a naive question. I asked a question about, do you see me as diverse? And I know you and your listeners see me, you know, through a square, and I'm a white female. And so at one point, the answer back when I asked the question, do you see me as diverse? The answer came back as, well, you're a woman. And I said, yep, that's a lens of diversity. That's that gender lens. And when we talk about diversity, we often think about race. We think about gender, and maybe we include sexual orientation in our conversations. And so the follow-up question I asked was, what about my disability? What about my limb difference? I was born missing a left hand. Sure. And the answer back when I asked about my limb difference was, oh, well, we don't see you like that. And I said, well, I'm not asking to be seen like that. I'm asking for it to be acknowledged as part of diversity. Mm. And it got me thinking, Furkan, about the idea of how are we defining diversity? Who are we including, and who are we not including in the conversation? And how come disability, the visible like mine and the invisible like mental health and neurodiversity, isn't part of the conversation, and yet it's the largest minority group?
Right.
And so that became a piece of my passion project, is to start to talk to companies where I had done a lot of fundraising and gotten mentors from and support, and realized that was a piece that was missing from the diversity conversation. And the second part to your question that I thought was really relevant in my work was, and I had fought for a long time, was that leaders needed to be part of the conversation early on, because right. You can't change culture without leaders. Mm-hmm. And I fought that forever in terms of my own leadership. I thought when people would come in for a job interview and say, what's the culture like here? I would answer back, well, I have a team of people. I'm not the only one that sets culture. But the truth is, what I learned, leaders need to set culture.
Yeah.
And there are varying leaders in organizations. Everyone's really a leader, but that in a hierarchical organization, leaders need to help drive culture and
right.
drive inclusion.
Yeah. And a lot of it has to happen through just leading by example. Right. And talking about it and not shying away from it. And that definitely needs to happen. Now, there's this other piece, right? So, and I just want to get your thoughts on it. But I think when you see someone with a disability or physical disability, there's that tendency in our culture not to point it out or talk about it. And I can see why it could be difficult for people to bring that up. Do you feel like that often creates a bigger problem than actually makes it easier for the other person, like, you know, on the receiving end?
Yes. I think that we have created a culture where we don't talk about disability. I mean, think back to young kids. Young kids are some of the most curious, often kind about, they're just curious about difference and disability. Mm-hmm. And so they will ask in a somewhat naive way, hey, what, and I'll take me for example, they'll say, hey, what happened to your hand?
Mm-hmm.
And immediately, within seconds, if an adult is around, whether it's a parent or a guardian or a grandparent, they rush in and they say, I'm so sorry, they just asked you about that.
Yeah.
And they scold the child. So we do two things. The message that we send to kids is don't be curious, because that's not a good thing. And so we squash that. And that's the beauty of children most of the time, because when it's with good intent.
Yeah.
And the second one, we send a message that disability is something we don't talk about. Disability is a bad thing. And so that starts really young with kids. And we've, as adults, we had that same message. So that's a piece of, let's start talking about disability. Let's name disability. Let's actually use the word disability and re-own it and reclaim it as something that is not a bad thing. It's a strength. It's a gift. It's something that's unique about us. It allows us to have different perspective and different experiences. And so that's where I think we need to bring the conversation back to is, let's own disability and talk about it and realize the other piece for Khan that's really super important is disability. This is a conversation for everyone, because at some point in everyone's life, disability will be part of it, whether it's being born with a disability, whether it's acquiring one at some point, or whether it's taking care of somebody with a disability. Disability cuts across all lenses of diversity and cuts across all lanes of our lives. So disability needs to be part of the conversation that we're having, whether it's about diversity or whether it's about using the word. Again, I've had people say, oh, I don't like the word disability. I'm like, that's because you're thinking of it as a word that means something bad. It's not a reclaimed word.
Yeah. And to your point, and in that example with children too, we create this culture of shame as well, that you shouldn't be asking something like this. And there's shame on multiple layers, right? For the child, for the person who's being asked the question, everyone's feeling this sense of shame, which obviously then becomes part of the culture. And the other piece I'm curious about, considering all the work you've done, a lot of organizations, like I've been part of the corporate culture for many, many years. There's a lot of talk about D&I, DEI, and it's a huge focus. Lots of talk about it, like I said. Where do you feel like there's still a lag? And why is there a lag still, considering the amount of focus and emphasis put on it?
That is a big question. I think there is definitely a lag. I think that with diversity, equity, and inclusion, in some ways, there were some impulse reactions to how we were setting it up. And I think what we did is we chose initially three lanes, really two lanes. We talk about race and we talk about gender, right? And I think that's where we started. And those are super important pillars. I want your listeners to know those are cornerstones to really the conversation, and in many ways, a reaction to things that have not been talked about for a long time. I think the other, you know, with Black Lives Matter increasing its visibility and George Floyd's death, we absolutely needed to focus on race in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion. That needed to be part of a conversation. And with the Me Too movement and gender equality, we needed to make sure that gender was part of the conversation. And there is also space for disability to be part of the conversation. It is equally as important in terms of conversation, given the history around disability. I think where we have some room is prioritizing it on the agenda of DEI. You know, it's funny, I read a statistic while I was writing my book single-handedly that with my TEDx too, I mentioned it, that 90% of companies prioritize DEI efforts, to your point. It is absolutely a priority for most companies. However, only 4% of those that are prioritizing it, does disability show up? So only out of that 90% of who are prioritizing it, only 4% concentrate on disability. And yet that leaves out then when we're having these conversations, people with disabilities, so they feel excluded in inclusion conversations. So that's a piece of it. I think the second piece is we ran to come up with solutions and to put things in place without necessarily thinking about some of the back pieces. And what I mean by that is I created this framework called the Cure to Inclusion, because I looked at what were the pieces that were missing from the conversation, not just disability. I mean, I'm thinking about ageism. I'm thinking about sexuality and gender identity, things like that. And what I looked at was, how do we actually, as ourselves, think about difference? Mm-hmm. What are our biases? What are the things that where we have felt different? So there's this understanding piece that before you engage in really good DEI work, you need to know where you've come from and where what your thinking is. So it's taking a step back to do the work in terms of what do you actually know about difference? In terms of all of the lenses and lanes of diversity. So it's taking a step back and doing the work, the proactive work in terms of understanding, because only then can you really connect with others. Mm-hmm. And that's C. So my model is called the Cure to Inclusion, and it focuses on connection, understanding, representation, and empathy. And we start actually with the you, because it's the you is the understanding piece. And then it's thinking about connection and how can you connect with others because you're actually really listening to them for the first time because you've done the work. And then it's doing almost what I call an inventory or an audit around whose voices are on your team, whose voices aren't heard on your team, who's represented in terms of an organization, and setting some goals around some of it so that you're intentional in terms of representation and how you're thinking. Again, diversity, though, means different perspectives. It means different experiences. It means companies valuing that piece of it. And then the last piece is around empathy, which is because I know and I can share, I grew up in a time when leadership, and in some ways this still happens, leadership was not about being vulnerable. Right. Leadership was not about showing the things that challenged you. It was about being strong and tough and wanting to create goal, return on investment. And that's important. And so are the people and the perspectives that they bring, because that's what drives innovation. That's what drives engagement. That's what drives people actually staying and retention in companies. And so I think there's a model that why I work with leaders, even from the first question where we engaged here, is I work with leaders because leaders, it's almost like a shifting of how we think about leadership in terms of if we're asking people in our companies to be vulnerable and bring their best selves to work and their authentic selves, we need that model with leadership. So they are creating those places to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And thank you for building on all of that. And to your point, when you said organizations often took they rushed into it and perhaps focused on representation only, at least that's what I noticed. There was a lot of focus on metrics. And for me personally, that didn't sit well because it almost kind of, in my mind, it took away from the actual aspect of understanding and empathy that you alluded to. Because now you're just focused on a number and getting that representation in so you can perhaps, it felt like a checking the box exercise. Is that mm-hmm. something you've seen? And what are your thoughts on this whole metric-based approach?
Yeah, I think I totally get where you're coming from. I think, though, if we don't have goals and if we don't measure things, then we don't know if we've moved the needle. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a need or a necessary piece to how do we set intentional goals, like benchmarks of what we actually want to do. And that requires thinking about what do we actually want to do, right, around diversity. So I think there needs to be discussion around what is the end goal with diversity, because I imagine you and some of your listeners may have very different ideas. So how do we come to a point of what is it that we're trying to do? How can we measure that we've made an impact or made a difference? And then I think the other piece is, though, to your point, there is a lot of just checking the box. I know that there are companies who, say, oh, well, it's a celebration month, so let's just do something for that. And then we kind of are done with it for the year. Right. Well, no. How do we translate that into all year thinking about those different groups? How does that, how do we show up that way? Right. Because it's not just a 1 month thing during the year where we celebrate different prides of different lenses of diversity, but it's how do we incorporate that? And that's where I think employee resource groups and affinity groups have their biggest opportunity, is showcasing that work all year long. And I actually think that the goal is not to keep us separate as employee resource groups, but to showcase the intersectionality of those groups and bring them to bring us together and highlight those, that piece, because I think that's where the real work get done.
Absolutely. The intersectionality is a huge point, because I'll share a personal experience too, because I mean, I'm of Pakistani descent and what would be considered a visible minority, I suppose. And often I feel like I get singled out because of that visible difference. And I know the intentions are good, that, you know, you're a diverse person, perhaps you should have a voice. But to me, when I look at it, if there's intersectionality, we don't need to point out that I'm different. Like, just let's just consider that we're all the same, right? So why do I need to feel singled out? So there's this almost, I like to say, it's like this exclusion by inclusion that I often experience. And I don't know if that's obviously the goal, and I'm sure people have really good intentions, but how do you change the narrative and the approach in those situations where you may want to include someone, but not by pointing out their difference, right?
Right. And it goes back to what I said, which was one of my pivotal moments through this, which was, I don't want to be seen like, right, quote unquote, with the quotes and, oh, that you're different. I want to be acknowledged that I come with different perspectives and different experiences. And let's turn this conversation back to, how do we celebrate difference, right? Because we all have differences. When we create workplaces where we're not allowed to showcase the difference, not that, again, to your point, not that we want to be singled out for it, but that I want to say, hey, what was your experience? How have you thought about this maybe differently than I am? Because you're coming at it from a different angle. Mm-hmm. So you're offering a different perspective that can move the conversation forward, or that can move a product forward. I know, given having been a CEO, the people that I wanted on my team were the ones that had been challenged by something in their life, who thought outside the box, who had to think two or three steps ahead. The toughest employees for me were the ones that would come into my office and say, I don't know what to do. I'm done. Yeah. The lack of problem-solving skills. And people, I can say, most people with disabilities or differences have spent their life thinking outside the box and creating solutions. And so that's where, can we change the narrative around diversity to look at celebrating differences and celebrating different perspectives and valuing different experiences? Because that's what's going to create that engagement. That's what's going to let me be seen and heard at work and not feel excluded. And that's what's going to make the innovative products and concepts that we want. That drives creativity. Mm-hmm. That's where I work with leaders on this, because that is where it starts. And I will offer, it's a two-way street. Yeah. It absolutely needs to be with leadership, and employees need to be in there too. Being, if your manager or a leader creates that space and has done the work with you, it's up to you to also show up. Yeah. It is not just a finger pointing one way.
Right, right. And on that, what do you think employees can do to your point, show up and perhaps support their leaders in that shift or making sure that their voices are heard, and to your point, not coming to problems saying I don't know what to do, but rather showing that creativity and thinking outside the box.
Yeah, this is probably a whole nother segment, because I think that there's a opportunity for employees on three levels. I know of two right now, so I'm going to come up with three by the end of this, I promise.
Okay.
I think the first one is allowing for leaders, like helping shift the conversation around leaders' vulnerability. So it's accepting that leadership can be vulnerable, that they can make mistakes. Just like employees want that same opportunity to be able to make mistakes and learn, it also, the same thing needs to happen with leaders, the way we value leaders and see leaders, right? So that's, there's an acceptance part to leadership. I think the second piece is for employees to get engaged in the affinity groups and the ERG groups and do the learning, do the proactive learning of different groups. So even if it's not your quote unquote group, learning about others is going to help the workplace and how other people feel seen and heard. You're creating a team. You're creating space for other to understand others. I know when it's interesting, when Black Lives Matter first came around in terms of the death of George Floyd, at least in my experience, and my staff said to me, what are we going to do? Like, what's the action plan? I realized there was a lot I didn't know. And so what I said is, I need to pause for a second. I need to go and outside do the learning. It is not your job as staff. It is not your job, the students and the families that I worked with, to teach me. I needed to go do the learning outside. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is equally important. It is not other people's job to teach us pieces of their story. It is our job to go and learn it and to be able to ask questions. And I think that would be the third piece that I would offer here is, being allowing for questions, because I think without getting in trouble, and we've created sometimes in a workplace the idea that if you ask questions out of curiosity and kindness and support, that you could get in trouble. That's not a healthy work environment. You should be able to ask questions. You should be able, and when they come from a place of curiosity and kindness and support, not because you're, you know, nosy, but because you actually want to create that space so that people can feel vulnerable. That's the idea. And for a long time, I didn't do that. I didn't know that that was okay. So I think those are probably the three things that I think employees could help with inclusion around.
Yeah. And it goes back to what you said earlier about the understanding and the empathy, right? And approaching those situations with vulnerability and perhaps saying, you know, I just have good intentions here. I just want to learn more. So, because I think the other fear is people are worried about coming across as offensive, right?
Right. Offending. Getting in trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So by just saying, I don't know this, I'm just trying to figure it out, I think that there's a deeper level of understanding and compassion, even in that, where the other person, even if the question may come across as offensive, would have an understanding on their part too, that this person's coming with the good intentions.
Right. It's assuming best intention. Right. And that, and you know, there's a gut check also. We know when people aren't coming with good intention, right? Like that's a space that we all kind of have felt, but wow, what if we did imagine good intention and best intention, and we allowed for questions. We allowed for curiosity. I mean, people ask me all the time, oh, well, are you okay with people asking, how do we ask about disability? How do we ask you about your hand? I'm somebody who has made that a green light. Like you can ask, because I want to make it so that you're not making assumptions about my ability. You're not making assumptions about my life experience. I want to share it. There are others, though, that I recognize who don't want that responsibility and don't want that open door. So we need to be okay with that too, because it's about boundaries, right? And how people want to be treated. So yes, sometimes it can be confusing because we don't know who has a green light and who has a red light. But if we ask, then we find out, and right, we are not making assumptions.
Yeah. And then to your point as well, the responsibility is a two-way street, right? If you want to feel included, you also want to be able to express what your boundaries are and what you're open to discussing, because then that makes it easier for others around you to be able to have those conversations.
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I often wonder and have thought about is, with anything new that you're trying to implement, and in this case, DEI, there's often the initial hurdles that you have to get over, right? And one of those is often the pendulum swings too far and you can be potentially overcompensating, or you can almost see people take advantage of certain things or play the victim. What are your thoughts around that? Because that's something I constantly struggle with in my mind, and I wonder if others think about it as well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think there's probably a natural life cycle to things, right? We embrace things, and then we kind of lose interest, and then we get excited by something else, and then we lose interest. I do think, however, for this to work and for this to be sustainable, for DEI to be sustainable, there's a few things that need to happen. I think that internally at companies, to your point, so that it doesn't lose, so we don't lose interest and that we don't see it as a shiny new object one day and then walk away from it what feels like the next day, mm-hmm. is there needs to be support. So there needs to be support from an executive level in terms of being a champion, being an quote unquote ally, but really, I think, a champion of the efforts internally for each of the groups and also for intersectionality. Mm-hmm. I think there needs to be a budget set for DEI efforts, because we know when there's money attached to something, we value it. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that means that we create space to have events and to be able to do things for a company. I also think that for DEI to really be sustainable, it is that intersectionality piece. It's that piece of how do we not leave people out of the conversation? How do we bring them in and recognize their diverse talents across things? Mm. And there was one more thing I was going to say in terms of, and then I just lost the thought. But yeah, I mean, I hear you in terms of the pendulum and the interest. I think that's where ERG groups, I think, are relevant in terms of making sure that the challenges and the opportunities stay forefront. And that's why you need executive support as part of this yeah. drive.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. No, I mean, there's a lot to think about there, right? Because I often wonder, as I mentioned earlier, when you start taking the checking the box approach, that can also be detrimental, because now I wonder if you start putting people in positions that might lead to, or setting them up for failure in certain cases, right? And that's something I also wonder. And how do you mitigate against that?
Yeah, no. And I thought about what I wanted to say, because it goes along exactly. Thank you for the reminder of it, is that it can't just sit within one area, right? Like, I think the beauty of DEI is that it falls within the talent life cycle of HR, from the beginning of when we are recruiting people to join a workplace, to when they're engaged in the workplace, to when they leave. So there's a HR talent life cycle that needs to think about DEI challenges and opportunities. There's a learning and development piece that also has DEI as part of its bandwidth. And so how are we integrating departments and marketing? It's how we're thinking about how we're serving our communities through marketing efforts and the messages we're sending out as a company of what we value. Like, how do we actually bring those teams together around this? Because that's when it enhances the work, right? I think that's when it becomes relevant for everyone.
Yeah.
Because it's part of all aspects of the company. It's even part of our clients that we work with, or our consumers or customers. So I think it's bigger than just a department of DEI. It's almost like it's a value statement that the whole company needs to work with.
Right. Yeah.
It's also why I go back to, Farkan, the idea of it's not just bringing in someone one time. It's how are we setting up conversations around, like, I think about often to your point around checking the box, a company will say, oh, well, we'll celebrate this month and we'll bring in a speaker, and then that's kind of it. And what I encourage companies to do is, yes, bring someone in like me as a speaker, right? And then what does the follow-up look like? What does the reinforced learning look like when, and the conversations? Because that's great for 60 minutes, but we know from adult learning, from child learning, that we need repetitive conversations. We need repetitive learning. So we need to make sure that the learning is reinforced. That's part of why I wrote the book. It was really supposed to be, and it really is, this idea of reading examples and vignettes. It's then the idea of insights that I came up with, and then reflection questions to reinforce what you just heard. Like, how is it relevant to you? Because this is just a story. How is that actually relevant to you? That's where companies can move the needle, like in terms of diversity and not just checking a box, is sustained learning. Mm-hmm. And that's how I work with companies, is through those kind of efforts.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you for building on that. And I guess we mostly focused our discussion on organizations and companies, but what about from a societal perspective? Because, you know, you can't have initiatives in society. I mean, you could to a certain extent, but it's hard to hold anyone accountable from that aspect. But yeah, how can we do a better job in society to be more inclusive, or even have that intersectionality? Because I feel that's where we struggle the most.
Yeah, we absolutely do. I think a piece of it, and this is where I have focused my writing and research as of late, is on this idea that most of us are hiding parts of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I come at it from personal experience, because I hid my limb difference for 25 years. And for a number of reasons. One, for rejection. I was afraid of rejection. I was afraid of judgment in terms of my ability. And probably the most damaging was the message I sent myself about my difference and my disability. Mm-hmm. And so I hid it. And what I found in writing and in researching is that most of us, Furkan, are hiding part of ourselves. And that's what keeps us disconnected from others. Mm-hmm. Because we're always worried that someone's going to find out, whether it's about disability, a visible disability like mine, or an invisible disability. But it actually goes deeper. Hiding is about, people hide things all the time. They hide their age. They hide their education. They hide their financial background. They hide their politics more than ever. That's what keeps us separated. So if we're so focused on keeping part of ourselves hidden, we're actually not really connecting with others. And the truth is, we're not really in alignment and connecting with ourselves. We're not really actually getting to know ourselves, because we're hiding that part, because we've built up a message that it's not okay, that it's damaging. Mm-hmm. And I think as individuals, I look, and with companies, so I'm going to go back to the company for a piece, but I think as individuals, how do we create space for people to unhide? How do we create space for people to be their best self, which means all their challenges too that come along with it? Mm-hmm. And that's where kind of my stamp is around the idea of this hiding piece. Like, how do we create a movement and a community for people to unhide? Mm-hmm. So that they can connect, because the key to connection, which we all so desperately want, is that connection with others. And we learned that probably more over COVID than ever before, even for those introverts who preferred COVID because we didn't have to, you know, connect in some ways. We still crave connection.
Yep.
And it's the social connection is so important. And so, but if we're holding something back about ourselves that somebody needs to know to be able to, quote unquote, support us, or to love us, or to hire us, or to like us, then we're not actually really connecting. And the key to connection is unhiding.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think connection is huge. And to your point, COVID really brought that to the forefront. Social beings, we need that sense of connection. And that connection needs to happen on an unconditional level, right? And I think, as we talked about earlier, if there's that sense of empathy, compassion, we can move past a lot of these barriers that we've created. And often these barriers are visible to a certain extent. And then once we have that level of understanding, then it's easier for people to show up as their true, authentic selves and not hide parts of themselves, which is detrimental on so many levels.
It's absolutely exhausting. It is lonely, and it takes a toll on our mental health when we're hiding part of ourselves. And I can tell you firsthand that when I share out my hiding journey with others, I immediately get this shoulder drop and exhale, because people are so grateful that I've unhidden something about myself, because they can feel connected and they can feel that they can be vulnerable. It's a safe place. And so part of it, what I've done is, because people ask me, well, how did you learn to unhide after all that time of those 25 years? And there's really a four-step method that people can start today. Your listeners can start today if they're hiding a part of themselves. It's first, it's recognizing that you're hiding, right? It's owning that piece of yourself that's hiding. It's then inviting someone in and asking for help to unhide. It's finding that person, it really only takes one person to start. Yeah. Finding that one person that you can share something, that part of yourself with. And then it's about finding community. And I think the beauty and the gift of social media, though, you know, people can debate this till the end of time. The beauty and the gift of social media is that you can find a community of anything on social media. I found a group called the Lucky Finn Project that way, from someone telling me about it. It was at that point when I first found it, was 30,000 members who had limb differences just like mine. I thought I was alone my whole life, not connecting, not realizing that there were so many people. That group is now over 70,000 in membership. There are resources online. There are places to get support. And so it's finding and building your community as the third step. And then the fourth step, Farkan, is sharing out your story with others, so that it becomes this loop of, I share out my story of hiding and now unhiding, and it helps someone else think about, well, who's the person I'm going to invite in and find that person. Right. They then go and build their community, and then they share their story and it helps someone else. That's the true nature of the way we're going to create this individual piece of people not feeling siloed and isolated and included.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've experienced that firsthand too in the men's groups I've been a part of, because men's mental health is definitely something I'm passionate about, but it's a huge issue. And to your point, often it takes one person just being vulnerable and it opens the door for everyone. And in that sense, courage is truly contagious, right? And so someone needs to take that first step, but it's creating that community, like you said, and finding your own community, whether it's starting from scratch or going out and seeking it. It's so crucial.
Absolutely. And the beauty of, again, social media and the internet is we don't often have to start from scratch, because somebody else, that shared experience, someone else has probably lived in those shoes or something similar. And so there are people out there to connect with, and it's easier probably now more than ever to find people to connect with, because we have the resource and the tools to do that. And I'm so glad you brought up men's mental health, because I think it's one of those pieces that where people are hiding. There's a statistic that 45% of, I think the statistic was 45% of white men are hiding their mental health. I think that number is actually probably a lot larger. And it's something we don't talk about when we talk about diversity and when we talk including it, and it needs to be.
Absolutely. I mean, I see that a lot, right? Because there's this whole notion of white privilege that gets thrown around, which makes it hard for white males to speak up, because they're like, well, I'll get shamed because I have privileges, right? So that is a huge issue also that's coming to the forefront. Hopefully we're able to work through it together.
Absolutely. No. And I think, you know, and the privilege is a different, is a whole segment of your show, I imagine you can address too, because it is real. And it doesn't mean that we need to leave men out of conversations. I actually, one of my core values is we need to include men in conversations, because we have things to learn about power and shift of power and privilege. And we also have things to teach in terms of how are we moving this forward. We can't do what we said we didn't want done to us. to someone else.
Yeah.
And so we need to, there's enough room at the table for us to move this conversation forward together.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's amazing. And thank you, Ruth, for sharing all of that. Thank you for coming on here. I appreciate everything you've shared. For listeners that do want to find you or get a hold of you, what are some ways they can do that?
Sure. I have a website. It's ruthrathblot.com. I am very active on LinkedIn. So Ruth Rathblot on LinkedIn. And then I think the two pieces that you mentioned before we got on here, or when we were on here, is my book, Single-Handedly, Learning to Unhide and Embrace Connection, is available in every format, from print to Kindle to audiobook. So people have an opportunity to read it and experience it that way. And then for those who want the shorter version, there's a TEDx that was When I Stopped Hiding, I Found Freedom. And so I'm also on Instagram, but I think those five ways of my website, my LinkedIn, and my book, and the TEDx and Instagram, I am there. And I'm really building a community around unhiding. That is the movement that I think will change the way that we think about connection.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, thank you for all of that. I'll definitely put that in the show notes as well. But thanks again for coming on here.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for amplifying the messages around diversity and unhiding, because I think they're critical to how we're going to move forward in the workplace and as individuals. So thank you for coming.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for checking out this episode with Ruth. As always, please leave a review or a comment in the comment section. I love hearing from you all. Or subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so. That's the best and easiest way to support the podcast. Thank you, and until next week.